We're back live here on Wednesday. Back from a little time on the road. Spent some time up in Dearborn, Michigan and Ann Arbor, Michigan this weekend. Took a day off to sleep, since we didn't sleep for about 3 days straight. And now we're back live this Wednesday. It is the 3rd, is that right? The 3rd of May. I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back to Issues Etc. In the first half hour of today's program, Pastor Bill Swirl is going to join us. We'll talk a little bit about intelligent design. We'll spend the balance of this first hour talking about the battle between a Lutheran church and the government over the funding of social services. Pastor John Maxfield, pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in St. Francis, Minnesota, will join us to talk about that. And then we've got audio open lines coming up in the second hour of the program. For the better part of that hour, we have something you may have seen on television over the last couple of nights on Channel 5, a series on the Gospel of Judas. Also, tomorrow is the National Day of Prayer. I was telling Jeff before we came on the air, these things just seem to come around more than once a year, but he assured me it is only once a year. We got a little audio from Shirley Dobson and Barry Lynn on the National Day of Prayer. And then the Missouri Senate race, the big issue is going to be, or so it seems, stem cell research. We'll have some audio on that as well during audio open lines coming up in the second hour of Issues, etc. Then at the very end of that, a sermon review. Starting in the second hour, we're going to review a sermon by Pastor Joel Baisley on the snake in the wilderness. You know this story from the book of Numbers. We'll be reviewing that sermon in our weekly sermon review. In the last 15 minutes of the program or so, 20 or 15 minutes, we're going to play a little Name That Religion. Remember how this works? We're going to play 4 sound bites all in a row, all in the same order every time we play them. And what we want to know from you, we'll give you the choices. We want to know what religion each one of these speakers is. There's 4 short sound bites, and then hear from you who's who will name that religion in the last 20 minutes on Issues, etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Bill Swirla is a regular guest here on the program. He is pastor of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California, and he's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled Intelligent Design, Science or Religion. Pastor Swirla, welcome back.
Christ is risen from the dead. Alleluia.
He is risen indeed.
Hallelujah. 3 weeks into it. And but that, by the way, is a matter of fact, not faith.
What do you mean by that?
That Christ is risen from the dead is a historic fact. That he's risen from the dead for your salvation, that's a matter of faith. But and that'll tie in at some point down the road, but we'll see how this goes.
Okay, well, let's talk about whether something is a matter of science or religion when it comes to intelligent design. Is intelligent design religion?
It's religious. That is, it has religious implications, but it's not religion, at least in the way that I understand that word. Religion would be some body of teaching that teaches who God is and how he is to be worshipped. That would be the way I would understand, and I think most people would understand the word religion. It's religious in that it makes some statements about the existence of the cosmos, the world, and the characteristics of it, and it has religious implications that the world as we observe it and experience could not, in all likelihood, have happened by accident, but that it betrays the work of some sort of design. But it doesn't really ever indicate who the designer is. So I really wouldn't call it a religion. If it named the designer and said how to approach him, that would be a religion.
So another term for religious, the way you're using it here, is perhaps it does have metaphysical implications.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you were to ask me, is evolution religious, I would have said the same thing. Yes, it's not a religion of sorts, but it has religious implications because it says that, the world as we know it and experience it is essentially the result of kind of nothing assembling itself into everything. That has profound religious implications.
Let's talk about intelligent design just by way of some definition here, because what people hear in the news is that it is a very thinly veiled attempt to introduce creation or the Bible or the book of Genesis or something like that into the science curricula. Having said it's not religion, but perhaps religious, what is intelligent design?
Well, I think part of what, you know, when you were talking about how it's veiled creationism, that to me is what happens when these kinds of discussions become political, because in political discussions, it always has to be one camp or the other camp, red or blue, liberal, conservative. So you're either an evolutionist or you're a creationist. And I think that's really unfortunate, because it's kind of the end of any meaningful discourse. The people who put forward intelligent design, as I understand this field of thought, are basically scientists or mathematicians who are saying, look, when we look at the world, either through a telescope, microscope, or however we look at it, we see order. It's an ordered universe. In fact, most scientists operate on this principle that the universe is ordered. There may be some mathematicians out there who would beg to differ, but, you know, a chemist or a physicist or something, where you expect certain things to happen in a certain way. That's why you have a periodic table for that reason. The material world behaves in an orderly way. Intelligent design sees order wherever we look, you know, microscope, telescope. Some examples would be biological systems have a high degree of order, and in fact, they would argue that the order is so complex that if a portion of a biological system is missing, the whole thing doesn't work. You know, you can't have three quarters of an eye. You have to have a whole eye. It's called irreducible complexity. Or you could just look at, like, the DNA code as an information system. And it's both highly complex and very specific. It's like a language system of four letters. And these things, usually, we don't expect these things to just kind of arise arbitrarily. You know, you can't take Scrabble letters and put them into a dump truck and have them spill out Shakespeare, you know, just in a random way. Now, I'm not saying that's how evolution works, but the whole idea is that you have a complex language code, like a computer code, like the software for your computers in your DNA. Other things are to look at the Earth vis-a-vis the entire cosmos as we see it through, like, the Hubble telescope or some of the satellite probes. And we realize that the Earth is kind of a rare planet, you know, that we've not seen any other planets like this one that have all the right components to support the sort of complexity of life that we know and experience day to day. And I guess the last one would be in the same realm, that the universe as a whole hinges on a series of very finely tuned universal constants, you know, everything from electromagnetic force to gravity to the intermolecular forces that hold things, you know, that hold things together at the subatomic level. These are all universal constants that are operative all throughout the universe. It looks, you know, from that point of view, as if there's some sort of hand that has kind of put everything in place.
Someone says, well, how do we know it's just not a phenomenon, an artifact of our perception? We are pattern-making, pattern-perceiving beings, and maybe we're just gestalting all of this order in this complex world wherein we live.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's a really valid kind of thing to ask, is design in the eye of the beholder. People who go, say, backpacking, and you're following a rather ambiguous trail. I know from my backpacking experience, a lot of times hikers that have gone on the trail before you will sometimes mark an ambiguity by taking three rocks and just piling them in a little pyramid shape, or four rocks. You make a little rock formation. And it's amazing, the eye picks up on that right away. You say, you know, somebody did that. You don't assume that grouping of rocks just sort of dropped out of nowhere and made that little formation. But we automatically, our eye picks that out of the whole landscape and sees that as a marker of the trail, even though it's made just simply of some rocks piled together. Or you look at Stonehenge, you know, and we say it's religious, we say it's got some kind of meaning. We don't say those rocks just kind of stood themselves up on end and that's how they've been ever since then. You know, we don't assume that's a natural occurrence. On the other hand, you know, you look at something like a snowflake, and the great variety of stones, these beautiful geometric designs. And that's actually the inherent properties of crystal and water. That's how water behaves and forms crystals. And some are, these are gorgeous geometric patterns. They look designed, but they only appear to be designed. And so it really is kind of a valid question. Is design something that is seen by somebody looking for design, or is it an inherent property like color or temperature or something like that that can be measured? And what the intelligent design people, especially the more mathematically ones, are trying to do is to demonstrate that there is some kind of objective measure of design. And that's really what that line of thinking is attempting to prove.
It strikes me there are some areas, some places, some things we can observe. You mentioned the snowflake, where someone could raise that valid objection. There are others that are so complex. If setting intelligent design against the theory of evolution, intelligent design seems intuitively to win hands down.
Well, you know, and this goes back. This is not a new thing. You know, a lot of people seem to think that this is something that has just kind of come up. It's a new way of presenting creationism that will, you know, pass muster in the school boards and stuff like that. And really, the idea of a designer and intelligent design, you know, goes back, I'm sure it goes back even further than Athanasius, but I like to always quote Athanasius, who was speaking against the Epicurean philosophers, and he said that just the simple distinctiveness of things argues not a spontaneous generation, but some kind of prevenient cause. And he says, from that cause we can apprehend God, the designer and maker of all. You know, this is a pre-scientific age, and not a man who's a scientist, but his approach is quite reasonable. When we see things that appear structured and ordered, our first intuitive conclusion is this was designed. This is we sense intentionality about it. When I walk down the block that I live on and I notice that all the houses have basically one of three patterns to them, I make the inevitable conclusion that the same builder built all of those houses, you know, that he had three blueprints and he built one of three on each of the properties.
I think that's an argument that's been made by guests on this program. And when we've talked about intelligent design, they have said, look, sometimes the very observations used by the evolutionist to argue for common ancestry of various species can also be used by the advocate of intelligent design to simply argue for, in the most basic way, a common designer.
Well, you know, think in terms of being in a jury, and you're hearing a criminal case. And the case is based on circumstantial evidence. You have no eyewitnesses to the event, but you simply have circumstantial evidence, a bloody knife, a few fingerprints, a footprint in the sand, some clothing discarded in a garbage can somewhere. And both sides are going to make a case about that set of evidence. You know, the prosecution will try to demonstrate that all of these pieces of circumstantial evidence fit a pattern that leads you to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty. The defense attorney will take the same group of facts, the same observations, and create a different pattern out of them, or perhaps no pattern at all, and explain each one of those events or each one of those pieces of evidence in a way that kind of discredits it or takes the picture, the what seems to be a clear picture, and kind of pulls it apart and creates doubt into your mind that perhaps there's another reasonable explanation. And then the jury is left to decide if it's a civil case, you know, on the preponderance of the evidence, or in a criminal case, beyond a reasonable doubt, not to any absolute certainty, just a reasonable doubt, that these facts kind of, you know, have been proven one way or the other. And that's really what you've got going here, is when you're talking about origins, when you're talking about how life began, how the cosmos began, or how the diversity of life has come to be as we know it, we don't have eyewitnesses to the event. We've got things in the fossil record. We have now increasingly genetic, you know, DNA evidence, which I think is going to be fascinating when we begin sequencing the DNA of all the modern forms of life and start to analyze. That's going to yield, I think, some genuine surprises scientifically. But these are all circumstantial pieces of evidence. They come together in a pattern, and one person will see it as in one pattern, and another person will say, hey, wait a minute, I have another way of explaining exactly the same body of evidence.
We're talking with Pastor Bill Swirley. He has written an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled Intelligent Design, Science or Religion. Our call in numbers 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. We are back live this Wednesday, the 3rd of May, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. To that issue of beyond a reasonable doubt, purely in the realm of human reason, our ability to observe the world around us, can we ever really expect anything more on this issue of origins than something beyond a reasonable doubt, Bill?
Well, I think when just think about life in general, nothing that we do in our day-to-day life is done to a higher degree than that. If you cross the street, you are not absolutely certain you're not going to get run over. You're just reasonably certain. You know, if you waited for absolute certainty, you'd never cross the street. You know, there's always that chance. That's how accidents happen. Accidents happen because we made a mistake somewhere. We were not absolutely certain of a thing. And whenever you're dealing in evidence that is circumstantial, and I'm contrasting that with, like, empirical science. So my field before I went into the ministry was in chemistry. Chemistry is purely an empirical science, so you don't need to make these kinds of presuppositions about how things arose. In fact, truthfully, in science, in chemistry, we never heard about evolution because it's irrelevant. In fields of physics and chemistry, you don't need that kind of a presupposition because you do experiments and you are present before the event, during the event, and after the event, and the scientist is in control of all the variables that occur during the course of the experiment. That's the nature of a good empirical experiment, is you are controlling the variables and you are observing the event all the way through. Obviously, you can't do that with the creation, with the Big Bang or whatever. Nobody was there before. And we're on the back end of the whole event, kind of looking at the echo and the outcome of things. And so it's always going to be purely circumstantial, and therefore it's always going to have holes and gaps in it. And we can only argue to a reasonable conclusion, a reasonable certainty.
So when Paul is talking early in the book of Romans about what can be known of God, and here he treats God as creator, what can be known about this great maker of all things, he says, is undeniable. He makes several points. It's undeniable. No one has any excuse. But it's also pretty limited what we can know by observing the world around us about the one who made everything. Where else then do we go for a higher degree of certainty as to who this designer, this maker is?
You know, you mentioned that Romans 1. I think Paul himself would agree with this notion of you know, at least in some broad way, of intelligent design, because, you know, he's basically saying the pagans are without excuse, even though they don't have the revealed word, which is where you're going to go for absolutes. You know, we talked about being absolutely certain about things. The revealed word will tell you who God is in his own terms. But those are scientifically untestable. You know, even simply the sentence, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, that is a scientifically untestable and therefore meaningless statement, scientifically speaking. That's just an absolute, flat-out point of departure for the Bible. Now, you know, Paul says that the pagans can look at the stars, they can look at the universe, they can perceive the order, and they'll know a couple of things about God. It's not good news, but they'll know that God is big, you know, he's eternal, he's all-powerful, and they can sense that there is something beyond them to whom they are accountable. And that's kind of his point in Romans 1. Nobody's off the hook.
So when we, as now speaking here, not only in the realm of human reason, but in the realm of divine revelation, when we examine what it is God has revealed of himself beyond simply what we can observe with our senses, who do we find?
Well, see now, and here's the wonderful thing, because I think in this whole debate, we sometimes think that science is the only tool in our toolbox to deal with truth. And it isn't. I mean, it isn't in ordinary life. Science does not deal in the truth of human relationships and the complexity of love and everything. Science doesn't deal with that. Science has a limited amount to do in history. But when we look into, you know, what God has revealed, we stare square in the face of God incarnate in Jesus Christ, who, you know, entered human history, became flesh, showed his face, was touchable. I love all these Easter texts that are coming up. He's constantly being touched in the resurrection. You know, last week he ate fish. You know, that gets back to my original point. So it's an historic fact that Jesus is bodily risen from the dead, and all the eyewitnesses are trundled out to you know, demonstrate this. Again, in the kind of evidence you would see in a courtroom, you know, credible witnesses, eyewitnesses. They touched him, they saw him, he actually ate fish. This was no dream, no vision, no apparition. It's the kind of case you would make in the court of law. And this is how God has revealed himself. He has become man. He has shown his face in the face of Jesus Christ. And Christ himself, the one who died and rose from the dead, points to the scriptures and he says, they speak about me. So he validates all of the scriptures. And he says, you know, you want to learn about what God's about? Go to them because they speak about me. And God in the flesh is telling us that.
Will you stick with us for about another 10 minutes here on the other side of the break, Bill?
Sure.
Pastor Bill Swirla is our guest. He's pastor of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California, author of an article in the latest edition of Higher Things magazine titled Intelligent Design, Science or Religion. Our call-in number, this break is a great time to call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address, and we are coming to you live this Wednesday, May the 3rd. Issuesetc@kfuo.org. Issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're talking about intelligent design. And when we come back, there are those who would look at this and say, all right, fine and good. Let's take the advocates of intelligent design at their word that they're not trying to push some sort of veiled religious notion. Then how should this be presented in the classroom? How should we be teaching this? If this is as reasonable, if not a more reasonable approach to the origins of life and the universe, then should it replace evolution in the classroom? Is that what should happen here? Or should it be set side by side? How do we sort all of that out? We'll answer those questions on the other side of the break with Pastor Bill Swirla. Join our conversation, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The reformer Martin Luther and his theology have been understood and misunderstood for almost 500 years. Was Luther's theology merely warmed over Roman Catholicism? Was Luther a Protestant? How important were the ideas of sin, grace, and the justification of the sinner to Luther's thought, theology, and Reformation? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May is called A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. To find out more, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the Issues, Etc. book of the month for May, A Theology to Live By, right there at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for A Theology to Live By.
From the National Institutes of Health, this is NIH Health Matters.
According to the 2005 Monitoring the Future survey, alcohol, cigarettes, and marijuana use decreased in 8th, 10th, and 12th graders in 2005. The information from this survey, which tracks illicit drug use and attitudes of 8th, 10th, and 12th grade students, helps identify potential drug problem areas among young people, according to Dr. Nora Volkoff, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse.
There's been a 19% decrease in the abuse of illegal substances. This is a dramatic decline. If one thinks about it, it's approximately 700,000 less kids using drugs.
We'll have more in our next report. For more info, visit www.nih.gov. From Bethesda, Maryland, I'm Bill Schmalfeld. This has been NIH Health Matters.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. It irritates me, spoils my prayers. Dear Father, we just... And then the prayer fills in whatever follows just. We just thank you for this day. We just ask you to be with us. We just want to praise you. I trust God's not bothered by it, but I am. I think it's the lack of eloquence. You are addressing your words to the great God of the universe, the one no sinner can behold and live. Not suggesting stiffness here, just a bit less casualness. I suspect the great prayers in the history of the church did not use the word just the way people today like to throw it into every other sentence in their prayers. There was an eloquence in older generations that is lacking today. Part of the reason for that eloquence was that the old-timers were not bombarded 24/7 by words and images. In other words, the great prayers of the past knew silence better than we know silence today. Writes Max Picard, when language is no longer related to silence, it loses its source of refreshment and renewal, and therefore something of its substance. So, if your personal prayer life is just so-so, spend more time in reverent silence before just opening your mouth. Thou art coming to a king.
Missouri Botanical Garden is once again giving area gardeners like you a reason to recycle. Plastic garden pots, polystyrene cell packs, and trays can be brought to the garden's nearby Monsanto Center and exchanged for a complimentary admission pass. Plastic pot recycling collections will be held from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays only, from May 20th through June 25th. Turn used gardening plastic into a ticket to the Botanical Garden.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Talking with Pastor Bill Swirla about intelligent design. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Coming up in just a few minutes, I think we're going to be talking with it's a very interesting story. This is a headline from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Church program won't care for woman who once was a man. If that doesn't confuse you, I don't know what will, but we'll be talking with Pastor John Maxfield of Trinity Lutheran Church in St. Francis, Minnesota, about the case that has come before them, the government refusing to send them any more people in need of help as part of their social outreach because they refused to help a woman who once was a man. We'll talk about it in just a few minutes here on Issues Etc. Bill, do you think that with intelligent design kind of rising in the literature, in the public discussion, as a reasonable alternative to evolution, do you think it belongs in the classroom as part of the curriculum?
That's a very tough question, because I think the classroom as we know it today is not able to bear this discussion. The classroom, and I mean this in the broader context, where the religious implications of scientific and historic observations are really not necessarily welcome, especially in the high school classroom. But you know, religion it's a funny place, especially if it has to do with Christian, the Christian religion in the classroom. And I think this is where the classroom's not able to bear the implications of this. I think in training good scientists, you have to train a person to let the facts lead you to your conclusion. That is, conclusions prior to the facts do not make a good scientist, nor a good historian, for that matter. I have a certain faith that science in the long run is quite self-correcting, but it takes a long time, and it takes a lot of vigorous debate, and usually the stuff that's in high school textbooks is well behind the current debate. So the kind of stuff you see about what should be taught in high school really, I don't think, reflects what's at the front edge of the debate. But I think the most important thing is to teach kids, especially, how to recognize an objective fact and how to let the facts shape a conclusion. Otherwise, you get into this whole business of, I know what I want to find, and now I'm going to go looking for it in history, in the rocks, or whatever. You know, in history, it's called revisionism. I'm going to rewrite history to suit my own agenda. And unfortunately, that seems to be happening in certain amount of science education, too. I think we should be teaching the kids what a good experiment looks like, what good scientific data looks like, and also then the limitations of science. It's one tool in observing the truth, but it's not the whole thing. And as human beings, we are in a rather unique position here to absorb the fullness of what God has revealed, not only in the natural order, but in his revealed word, too. And so I think the discussion has to be much broader than that. But at the basic level of a science classroom, I think just throwing out something like, you know, natural events must be caused naturally is, you know, I was trained as a scientist before I was a theologian, so I know a dogma when I hear one. And that's a dogma, to put a conclusion kind of out there as something I can't test, but I must assume to be true in order to move on. That's not science.
So you mentioned before that in your previous vocation as a chemist, you could deal scientifically, do experiments, without ever really addressing the issue of origins. We've had guests on this program when we talked about intelligent design who've argued, look, what we need in the classroom is we need to leave the question of origins with its religious implications out of the classroom, if we're going to be fair, and simply teach biology, chemistry, genetics, astronomy, the other sciences, as their fields, as observational science, and leave the issue of origins outside the curriculum. What do you think?
You know, in a sense, that's limiting it the other way too. I think that again, let the facts lead you where they're going to lead. I would much prefer a vigorous discussion in a classroom that exposes bias. You know, do you have a bias? Are you biased because you are a believer? Are you biased because you're an unbeliever? You know, that's a bias too. I mean, it's much easier to accept evolution if you're an unbeliever. And to discuss, you know, how an objective scientist or an objective historian or anybody recognizes his or her own biases and factors that into the observation. You see, there's no such thing as an unbiased observer. We all have our biases. The objective observer recognizes what those biases are and lays them face up on the table so everybody can see that. And I think, you know, that would be part of a good educational, good science education, to teach people what it is to be an objective observer of the facts. I have a quick story here. It's like a detective goes into a crime scene, sees a corpse with a knife sticking out of its back, and concludes it has to be a suicide because we don't have murders in this community. That's not good detective work. You have to look at the evidence and entertain all possibilities. The butler did it, the maid did it, it was a suicide. And then you rule out the ones that are least plausible and you explore the ones that are most plausible. That's just good detective work, good history, good study of the fossil record or of whatever, but it's being open to conclusions that may be a little uncomfortable, you know, and that's the thing, is many scientific observations, when you're looking at the big picture of the universe or the small picture of subatomic particles, can lead one to some very disturbing conclusions if you're an atheist.
Jeff is calling from Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, where he listens on the Internet. Jeff, thanks for being patient. Welcome to Issues 7.
How are you doing?
Very well.
Good. I've been following the ID movement for a while now, especially since Philip Johnson published Darwin on Trial. And Early's off and on, following in depth and not in depth. But I would be very much against teaching it in classrooms for one reason. Basically, it's very hard to find someone who can accurately tell you what the theory is if they disagree with it. And just on that basis alone, I've seen so many logical errors, ad hominem, straw men, that sort of thing, that I think high school students would probably, if they had a philosophy course where they had to accurately recount, like, what somebody said and then critique it and then learn the laws of logic, would they be in much better shape.
Okay, I see what you're saying there, Jeff. Thank you very much. It's a good thought. So his concern there is that ID, if taught in the classroom, would be subject to mischaracterization, either intentional or unintentional, on the part of the teacher or the students. What do you think, Bill?
Jeff raises a really good point. And in fact, I want to catch a second point first. I could not welcome enough courses in formal logic in high school. I mean, I certainly wish I had it. With the reminder, of course, that somebody is guilty of a logical fallacy doesn't mean that his point is wrong. It just means that he's guilty of a logical fallacy. That is, he did not proceed according to the rules of proper reason. You haven't proven a point by identifying a logical fallacy. And the same holds true on the other side. If you read the defenders of evolution, they are as ad hominem as anybody else. But I think that part of being a good observer an objective observer is to know logical fallacies and to recognize a poor argument when you've heard one. You may have kind of a headache when you hear something like that and you don't know why, and formal logic would really help. It's also true that intelligent design is not a dogma the way, say, the naturalist presupposition in evolution is. That's really a concise dogma that says that a natural occurrence must have a natural cause, you see. And so science must find a natural explanation for everything. There's a problem in that, is that in science, only statistically meaningful data are allowed in. If I do something 100 times and 99 times I get this result, and one time I get a totally different result, that one time is thrown out as being statistically irrelevant. See, now, that tells me right away that science can neither prove nor disprove a one-time miraculous occurrence, what we call a miracle. Nothing to say about that.
Because all of them, by definition, at least according to the way we observe the world around us, all of them, by definition, are statistically irrelevant because they happen less than one time out of a million.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, science deals in the reproducible, the observable. I remember those guys who thought they discovered cold fusion many years ago, and everybody said, big hoopla over this. This is huge. It's going to solve the energy problem. Well, they tried doing it at other labs, and lo and behold, it didn't work. It was non-reproducible, and they sort of ferreted out what the error was, and now gas is, you know, 350 a gallon, so it didn't solve anything. but that's the nature of science. But it can only deal with the reproducible and the testable. And see, I think, again, in a science classroom, there should be a vigorous debate. Go ahead, talk about origins, but look at the facts and say, is this reasonable? Is this a reasonable conclusion? And what are the potential biases, one way or the other? You know, I don't expect them to all sing a Te Deum and start praying in the science classroom, although I kind of resent that experiment where they tested prayer in the laboratory. Did you see that?
Yes, I did.
You know, I love how scientists object when you know, a little religion leaks into the laboratory, but they don't hesitate to stick prayer in there, you know, and test it to see if it works. You know, I'm glad it didn't.
Finally, Bill, with only less than a minute here, you have written, the Christian faith doesn't stand or fall on a concept of intelligent design. It stands or falls on the crucifixion, resurrection of the creative Word made flesh, Jesus Christ. What's the point there?
The point is this, is that when we look at you know, the splendor of the universe, we do not hear or see the gospel. And the glorious revelation of God, certainly the skies proclaim the works of his hands and the heavens declare his wonders, but the mercy and the grace of God that saves us is found in the face of the one who died and rose to literally redeem this cosmos from its own death and our sin. And that's the Christian faith. The Christian faith is about the death and resurrection of the Son of God in the flesh, who came to redeem the cosmos from death. And that's the beauty of it. He has embraced this he is the Word that created all things, and that same Word in the flesh has redeemed all things in his death and resurrection. That's the Christian faith.
Pastor Bill Swirl is pastor of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled Intelligent Design, Science or Religion. You can find out more about Higher Things magazine at higherthings.org, higherthings.org. Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, for the remainder of this hour, we're going to spend some time talking about a headline you might have seen even here locally. Church program won't care for woman who once was a man. Joining us to talk about this story, Pastor John Maxfield. He's associate pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in St. Francis, Minnesota. They're part of the story. Pastor Maxfield, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon. How are you, Todd?
Doing well. What kind of reaction is the church there, Trinity Lutheran in St. Francis, getting after this story breaks that you have refused, I suppose we would call this person a transsexual, on a moral basis?
Right, yeah. A varied reaction. Most importantly, from the congregation itself, it's been 100% supportive, and people are proud of a church that takes a stand, proud in a humble way, that we are grounded on the Word of God and that we don't mince our words when we talk about that and implement our policies. From the public generally, not only from the metropolitan area here, but throughout the nation, I've gotten primarily negative responses, very naive views of Jesus and the whole issue of morality, kind of the expressions such as Jesus ministered to prostitutes, what's the matter with your church? And that certainly is a challenge for any pastor, but especially a Lutheran pastor who believes that our church is grounded in the gospel of the forgiveness of sins, as ours is. But the whole issue of law and gospel as it relates to ministering to people. But more importantly, the difference between ministering to people on a personal basis and admitting a person that would threaten the very nature of the program we offer to the community is a difference that many people that have corresponded with us have not noted. Finally, then, we have received encouraging phone calls and emails also from the public regarding our church being willing to take a stand on what we believe.
Give us the history of this story, if you would, Pastor Maxfield.
Well, our church has run for about 3 years now, prior to my arrival here, which is just a little over a year ago, an adult daycare service for mostly for older people that need full-time care, and mostly it's a service to relieve their caregivers of 24-hour daycare. They come to our service for approximately 6 hours a day during the days that they're in the program. We also serve in the community people that that are incapable of caring for themselves fully, former people that have formerly abused drugs and are not able to make good decisions, people that are mentally incapable of providing supervision for themselves. So we have a varied group of people that come anywhere from 1 to 3 or 4 days into our program. The program was started on the assumption that it would grow to support itself, but it has always been heavily subsidized by the congregation as a ministry of our church to the broader community. And part of that has been a relationship with Anoka County. We've had a contract since the beginning of our operations with the county because many of the people that are interested in our program are eligible for public funding, probably federal sources for that public funding, but it is funneled through the county agency that has had a contract with us for several years.
So go on if you would. How did the conflict with the county and then the whole story unfold from that point?
Right. Well, I guess as foreground, I need to say that in our contract with the county, there are general statements about non-discrimination, many of which we are exempt from by law regarding how those laws apply to religious organizations. But our handbook, which the county has as an addendum to the contract, is very clear on the nature of our service as a faith-based service, as a service that is not really institutional but community-based. And really essential to our program is the way we encourage the interaction of our adult daycare clients with the people of our church, and especially the children of our day school. Well, in I believe it was late April or early May of last year, the county caseworker brought a potential client to be interviewed for screening and for the program. And I did not meet this individual, nor did the other pastor. But after that interview, the program director spoke with our senior pastor and indicated to him that this person who came was what she said was transgendered. She described the person as obviously a male dressed as a female with a wig on. Apparently, in that early discussion, it was even a question as to whether this person had actually had sexual transgendered surgery or was still actually a man simply dressing as a woman. And at any rate, it was determined through the normal process of screening that this individual would not benefit from our program and would not be compatible with the nature of our program, so we declined to accept this person into the program, at which the county indicated to us that they believed we were discriminating and that would threaten our contract relationship with them. And that was May. We went back and forth with them in friendly negotiations for 6 months. Before they finally, in writing, did accuse us of essentially breaking the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which does have a statement on non-discrimination for sexual orientation, but which also has a very clear clause exempting religious organizations and any of their functions from that part of the law. However, in that law, there is also the statement that secular business activities of religious organizations are not exempt from the law. And so the county replied, they regard us as a secular business activity, otherwise that we would not be eligible for public funding on the basis of so-called church-state issues. Well, what that does is it fundamentally changed the relationship we've had with the county, a very positive relationship, by the way, for the past 3 years. Our handbook is very clear about the nature of our program as a faith-based church community program. We have not changed. Our very clear non-discrimination policy does not include sexual orientation among its provisions, for obvious reasons, I think, to any Christian that understands the moral ethics involved. So we look at this as a reverse course on behalf of the county to change their position toward our service, which has effectively terminated their involvement. I mean, they still continue to. We signed an addendum to the contract when they stated they would not send us a new contract. And that addendum basically states they would continue to support clients that we already have so as not to disrupt their lives, but they would not be referring any additional clients to our program.
So what was the heart of the congregation's concern with an involvement of this transgendered person in this program? How would you describe that concern?
Well, the congregation as a whole hasn't been involved in it. In fact, a lot of this was kind of news to them when it became more public, although, of course, we've discussed the issue over the course of the last 6 months. It was the concern of the program director in consultation with the pastor that a person very outwardly and obviously transsexual would be uncomfortable for other clients in the program, and it would threaten a key provision of our program, which in our handbook is described as an intergenerational program. The program, it says, is designed with the focus of the clients to be seen as a resource and nurturing role model for children in our day school. And the children participating in the intergenerational activities develop strong bonds and positive views of aging by allowing the clients to share their experiences, culture, and wisdom. Well, with a program like that involving children, it's obvious that it's quite different from an institutional program. We admit clients of all kinds of backgrounds, and very few of them are members of our church or have become members of our church. Nevertheless, their behavior has to be appropriate for a Christian context, and in particular a context that involves children of a Christian day school. And we thought it quite obvious, and believe that the county should have seen it as quite obvious, that a transgendered or transvestite individual would not be appropriate for that context.
So this has been resolved. The program continues. The people who were at the time being supported by the county with funds through your program are still supported. You are admitting no new participants in the program, and that's the resolution of this, as far as I can tell. Has it made the staff there or the congregation in general wary of involvement in faith-based initiatives or faith-based programs with the community? Only a minute here to respond.
Sure. Because essentially we had what we believed was a very clear relationship and positive relationship with the county, and that changed literally overnight and placed us in a position of having to restructure our program, reducing staff, recognizing it was not going to continue to grow because so many of the clients are dependent on public funding, et cetera. So, yeah, I think it's that old issue of once government is involved in any aspect of a congregation's services, the government may well seek to determine the nature of your program. And it is a threat to religious liberty. As the Minneapolis Star Tribune article made clear, the whole issue of faith-based organizations is one in which the government has not clearly thought through its position. And this is a great example of that.
Pastor John Maxfield is Associate Pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in St. Francis, Minnesota. Thank you very much for being our guest, Pastor Maxfield.
Thank you. It's been great talking with you.
When we come back from this break, we've got audio open lines for your questions and your comments. Well, Channel 5 has been doing, at least so far this week, a two-part and promises to be, I believe, a four- or five-part series on the Gospel of Judas. Now, I will look through the first two parts. We're going to play them for you on the other side of the break. Very interesting stuff. Pretty balanced approach to it. They have a local flavor to it. We'll hear those things and get your questions and comments during Open Lines. It's Audio Open Lines after this. We'll also talk a little bit about the upcoming National Day of Prayer.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.